Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And here we go with the centennial episode, episode minute 100. And Hal, we've got a special guest again today.
We do. Returning for another round of abuse is are you the Murray the K? No, you're the George Martin of our.
I'll take the fourth guy
yes,
spot.
Yes, you're the fourth Avenger,
the Invisible Avenger, whatever they call it.
Invisible Avenger. Pretty much lifelong friend and composer and musical genius of Brand X Music, Tom Geyer. Tom, welcome back.
Thanks, guys. Pleasure to be here.
You know, plenty more to talk about after that last minute.
Yeah, we got hung up at the minute 32. Jim made us all stop talking. He's funny.
Well, Hal was finishing his lunch and didn't want him to, you know, go back.
That's true. Yeah.
He had to get that Lipton cup of noodle soup.
I had to go be employed.
Real jobs. Ew.
Yeah.
Ew.
Exactly.
Wow. Well, working man, tell us what's going on in minute 100.
All right. Minute 100. In the Red Skull's speeding roadster, Steve Rogers and Peggy Carter share a fleeting, intense kiss. Peggy pulls back, her eyes fierce. Go get him. Steve glances at Colonel Phillips, who raises a hand. I'm not kissing you. Steve slings his vibranium shield onto his back and climbs to the front of the roadster. Sparks fly as the shield grazes a Valkyrie propeller. In the cockpit, the Red Skull grits his teeth, pulling back on the control yoke as the massive flying wing nears the hangar exit. Steve leaps, grabbing the plane's landing gear. Phillips yanks the roadster's wheel hard left, spinning the car backward on the icy runway. It skids to a stop, rear wheels teetering over the mountain's edge. From the air, Steve glances back at the receding runway. Peggy, leaning over the roadster's back, watches the Valkyrie carry Steve skyward. The landing gear retracts into the aircraft's belly, pulling Steve inside as the plane soars into the clouds.
Before we talk more about the music, I just want to point something that bothers me. It doesn't bother me. I'm impressed by the Red Skull's branding. He has a great branding discipline, because if you look at the last seconds there on the linchpin for the landing gear, there's little hydras all over it. And I thought he really sticks to the script.
It really does. I hadn't noticed that.
I'm scrubbing right now. I'm looking for it.
Wow,
that's really cool. That's the maker's stamp. Boink.
Yeah, exactly. The other thing I do notice that this is the roadster. I never noticed this before, but this is the backwards version of Lady Penelope's Fab One from the Thunderbirds. It's got the double wheels.
Yep.
And
So.
It would have been. I don't think the Red Skull would have gone with a pink roadster, though.
Well, Pink Skull would.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of you gents have watched the League of Extraordinary Gentlemen movie.
Yeah, yes.
Oh, yeah.
But it had a car that I think had about 18, 20 wheels on it.
That was just a great vehicle design. Really
good
stuff. That was
an amazing vehicle. Not to a great purpose of a movie, but a great vehicle.
But, and a wonderful exhaust manifold. The giant pipes coming out of
the
side.
I wasn't the vehicle design overall in that film. I mean, the ships, the airs, the dirigibles, all of that's so steampunk amazing. Right. It's such a turd of a movie. Oh, wait.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's so disappointing, because we have not really had a definitive good steampunk movie. You know, we get elements of it, we get pieces of it, and it's fascinating to me that it's and maybe you guys would disagree, but to me it's kind of a genre that fascinates me, and I love the aesthetic, and everybody sort of instantly knows it when they see it. But it's kind of a genre that's been in search of like an anchor, or search of a really good vehicle.
Would you call Sky Captain and the World of Tomorrow, or is that more of an Art Deco?
That's Art Deco. To me, that's about 30 years too new, I think.
Well, it's not only Art Deco, but it was all in the box green screen.
Right.
One of the very early ones. Yeah. And so, they didn't. And for me, I'm with you, man. The other part is, like, it seems like the Matrix stole it and then shifted it into high tech. Like, that, the whole found where today's technology is decrepit, right? That part of steampunk they got right.
Yeah.
But it wasn't the valves and the screws and the springs. It was circuitry and LED lights. And so the one that I was wishing they would do, Gore Verbinski was tied to it to do BioShock.
Oh, yeah.
And that'd be good. I don't know if you guys are gamers or not, but I've played all of the BioShocks, and I adore the new one years ago, Infinity. That went more Art Deco and sort of left the steampunk aesthetic behind. But the first couple of those were amazing, and Gore would have made that world come alive. But
that would have been
didn't work out.
Yeah, that would have been spectacular. I actually fairly recently started that series from the beginning, the remastered ones on the Switch too, and just. That's some of the best world building.
It's so good. And then having the game. All of the sort of ink spotsy, you know, I mean, Fallout did it too, where they took the sort of old timey music and used that as atmospheric. But right. I really, really like how Rapture feels with all of that. It's so cool.
Yeah.
Oh, someday, Hal, you'll get a steampunk movie. The thing, as we're talking about the kind of combination of steampunk failures and just failures in general, I felt always bad about Sky Captain because it had such a great Edward Schirmer did the score.
Such a good score.
And it's beautiful. I mean, I play that a lot. And it's like the movie is but the music is stunning for the
It had all the right parts. And I just think I think it just comes down to the story. You know?
Agree.
It wasn't in the typewriter.
It was just a little bit lesser than the sum of its parts, which is tough. I still have a deep affection for it. I still love it. I went on Kickstarter 2 years ago and got the, you know, went all in on the big making of thing. And I've got a portrait in my office, an original hand painted triumphant pilot helmet and goggles portrait done by Carrie.
Wow.
Was it Carrie Conran? That all came as part of this thing. And I remember trying to explain it to a friend of mine who we have a lot of common tastes and things and say, you got to see this movie. You know, it's not perfect, but I have this affection for it. You got to watch it. And he was bored to death. And he goes, what are you, you know, see, the story was kind of tepid and whatever. I said, there was giant robots and skyscrapers and airships and like transforming P-40s. It was full of cool stuff. And he goes, yeah, but the story wasn't. I said, but I like it for the stuff. Shut up.
It's a pig with lipstick. I'll leave it alone.
Exactly. I mean, and it was all built on like Macintoshes over in Van Nuys in the middle of the porn district.
We met those guys. I mean, it was really interesting. Before Ed was assigned to it, we were working on a trailer. And that's what they were trying. You know, this is in the box. What does that even mean? Like, we couldn't conceive of, they're in this tiny little, as you say, in the neighborhood in Van Nuys where they make porn movies, shooting this ridiculous script with, you know, very minimal props and absolutely no stage whatsoever. And they're telling us all it's going to grow up to be. And it was like, I was so excited. And then,
Well, in many ways, it was maybe a bit before its time. I mean, I don't think the technology hampered it.
No,
drastically.
My problem visually is not.
Yeah.
I thought it was a great proof of concept. It was oh my God, look what they can do. Yep. And then let's just do it better next time.
Exactly. Yeah. So, Hal, what's your favorite candidate for the proper steampunk? I mean, what novel are you looking to, or original source, or what do you think?
You know, and that's the thing is, I don't even necessarily have a book to point at. It's more, that's what I think what fascinates me about this as an aesthetic is because it kind of sprang forth organically. I mean, there's some Jules Verne, there's some of this and some of that. And certainly like the Nautilus, recent Nautilus series. I don't know if any of you guys got a chance to see that. It's not perfect, but I really enjoyed that. And that I think kind of revels in that. When you think about, what was the movie? The airship movie. It wasn't like Voyage to the Top of the World, but it was something like that. Late 60s.
Oh, yeah. Hugh O'Brien. Not Hugh O'Brien. Doug McClure. Doug McClure. Island at the Top of the World.
Island at the Top of the World. Yeah, exactly. So there's, you know, there's things like that. But it's, you know, for me, it's more about, you go to cons or toy shows or whatever, and you see somebody's done action figures, somebody else has done posters, and somebody's done sort of all of this what if stuff, and it's like there's this chunk of people who just think this aesthetic, this concept is cool. And you know, I would love to just really dig deep one day and figure out, okay, where did it actually start?
Because I just thought like of a candidate. I thought of a candidate. Wild Wild West, the Will Smith.
The Will Smith one? And I think that's the closest we've come.
I agree. They really tried. Yeah.
They tried.
They tried.
Have you guys watched Arcane, the cartoon, the animated show?
No.
It's on Netflix.
Arcane.
Yeah. Okay. And it's a League of Legends. So it's, you know, it's a video game world derivative, but it's gorgeous, first of all. Plotline, amazing. Characters, great. Jinx, all of these things. But I think how you would go, all right, it's animation. It's not live action. But boy, did they nail me some Art Deco steampunk and then also huge commentary on socialism and inequality of income and science. Like, because you can make the invention, or Jurassic Park, just because you can, should you? So many of these core issues, such a great program and great, great score. Really, really worth your time.
Okay, I'm just going to step away and start watching that. So you guys talk amongst yourselves.
Yeah, Jim, you go watch Blue-Eyed Samurai. I'll go watch Arcane. Brian, what are we watching?
We have our homework. Brian's making you watch Wild Wild West again.
Yeah.
The Wild Wild West.
Gosh. We actually were on the trailer for that forever, trying all of these different things. They've, Mr. X and fun and not fun and action series. And then all of a sudden, oh, we'll cut a track. We're going to use that. And so then Will's Wild Wild West rap tune or whatever made all of the things and all of our stuff ended up on the floor. Which, so,
now you have to admit that is a perfect late 1800s period song.
Yeah, of course it is.
If you want to get in touch with your urban Wild West roots,
Victoria and Miami. Yeah.
Yeah, Victoria Miami, exactly. In the club.
Our listeners can't see, as I can see on Zoom, Tom's in a room with a lot of many instruments and different sorts of things. Tom, I got to know, do you own a theremin?
That's a great question. I do not own a theremin.
You want to?
I do. Yeah. I've looked at the Moog one, and then there's a couple of pretty cool kits that have come out that you can build yourself. Do you have one, Brian?
No, but I'd love to build my own.
Yeah.
I would love to. I've looked at the same kits and plans and stuff, and someday I'm gonna pull the trigger.
You should
I've had the kits on the wish list forever too. And I know it's gonna be one of those things. So my journey with musical instruments is get intrigued by one. At this table, Brian, I don't know if you play anything or not, but I'll guarantee you I'm the fourth worst musician in this in this room right now. For me, here's what would happen with me if I got a theremin is I would get it. I'd be super excited. I'd get to where I could do the thing in Good Vibrations and then maybe one other song and then be kind of stuck. And then every 6 months I'd come back and play those same two songs again and love it. But
that's how my son is. He bought a banjo and learned two Mumford and Sons tracks. And he could play his two Mumford tunes on his banjo, and that's it. He'd put it down, he'd forget, and then he'd have to practice Mumford for another 3 weeks when he finally played it.
Then you got to relearn it. And then...
Exactly. I'm sorry, stepped on you, Jim. You were saying something.
Oh, no, I was just saying that I picture Hal just doing all Ed Wood things. He'd be, ooh.
Yes, exactly.
That's what I would do.
Right.
That's
got to add some atmosphere somehow.
It's best purpose and cause.
Very true. What's funny to me with stuff like that, too, is what we were saying in the previous episode of how somebody goes, this is a weird sound. Let's put it against sci-fi. And now for some reason, this theremin thing becomes like, oh, instant Bernard Herrmann's sci-fi music. Like, why did that association get made in the first place? I mean, when did he stumble across that? And then how did everybody go, oh, yeah, that's what vintage science fiction sounds like. But also, Beach Boys or whatever. So it's pretty fun. Yeah.
I did have sort of a big picture question I wanted to ask you, Tom. And this is as a composer, do you have a library of musical influences or references in your head? Like, do you think, this would be a perfect spot to break out a little John Philip Sousa or something like that? Or, how do you think about those things?
It's a very interesting question. I think it's very relevant to, I'm going to do something here. Dare me. Somebody dare me.
I dare you.
Okay. AI. There, I did it. There's a big, in the musical industry, and is in a bunch of industries, I'm sure, AI is the big boogeyman right now. And because I can go to Suno and I can type in a prompt about, hey, write me a country song about eating too many beans and farting in church, and it literally in 2 seconds makes a masterpiece that makes me laugh, right? That's just the truth of it. But the big argument for copyright is that because the data set that the AI was trained on is all of human music owned by all of these people, anything that the AI can do, it's doing as a derivative of unlicensed stuff that it trained on, right? Well, yeah, I agree. And I'm backing all of that mostly for self-preservation until I can, you know, be too old to worry about it anymore. But really, if you think about human, we're not really any different. And so I've spent my life absorbing music into my into my sponge. And sometimes it's cognizant, like, wow, you know what? There was that thing I heard John Williams do in the blah, blah, blah in this scene. I wonder if something like that could work. Absolutely. Or, wow, there was that, you know, as the levee breaks, I want that John Bonham drum sound from Levee Breaks, right? That's, so it can be, or it can be, okay, that's Back to the Future. Alan, great, love you. But now, what can I do with that? Or there's three notes from that that are... So yes, it does roll around in the encyclopedia. And it does get brought out. You know, we are a sum of our experiences, I guess. And so it's an interesting thing. When I was listening to recordings of myself, let's talk about me as a pianist, right? And how drummer or whatever. When you listen to young you, you can really hear, like, well, he stole that riff from, you know, that's the Beatles fill from blah, blah, blah. And that's what Keith Moon played on such and such. And so my playing was a little bit of Chick Corea, a little Oscar Peterson, a few licks from a blues player, whatever. And when I would listen, it sounded like that, like a montage, right? A collage. And then as you get older and more experienced, those ideas, if you listen, you can still hear the callback, but hopefully they become integrated into your own vocabulary. And now you have ownership and you begin to form these ideas. And although they have a common ancestor, hopefully you can sort of shape and morph them to be your own style and sound. And sometimes your signature is simply the way that you combined your five favorite things, right? Yeah. You didn't necessarily come up with anything original. You just changed the recipe and then tweaked on it until you liked it. So does that answer your question, sort of?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I find that in my own art and writing and cartooning and things that I do is everybody starts out being derivative and you copy the people you love and admire.
This is how to draw Mickey Mouse. Okay.
Yeah. And then it all goes into the hopper. And I think the more things you take in from various sources, not just like, you know, I'm a cartoonist, so I've studied the cartooning greats of, but I've also love Renaissance art and I love Salvador Dali and I love all these kinds of influences. It all goes in there. It all goes into the mix master and you let it marinate for 5 or 10 or 20 years. And then that's you. Yeah. It's just you. That's your style.
Amen.
And it doesn't look like anybody else. I can look at it and say, well, I learned that. I derived that from this person.
That's a so-and-so's hand. That's the way they do hands, right?
But yeah.
Right?
Nobody else would see that because it's just me now.
And Jim, you're an engineer, yeah? Originally, I mean,
I did programming and things like that. Web stuff, you know, and I built lots of websites and things. But you know, it's one of those things that you learn first by copying. How do you do, you know, how do you do this? How do you do that? You know, it's, you know, if you're taking piano lessons, the piano player, you know, the teacher plays something, and then you try to play like they're doing. You know, and it slowly integrates. You get this synthesis in your head of this is how it works, and this is what works. This is what does. And the same thing with podcasting. I mean, putting this podcast together, I heard Star Wars Minute, I heard Indiana Jones Minute. I've learned how all these other ones are. I picked and chose all the different elements that they do in theirs. But then our show is a little bit different than everybody else's. You know, the 2 million other podcasts that are out there. I hope. But you know, anybody
pure distillation of the art form. This is
yeah,
it right
yeah,
here.
And it's like, and you might not even realize you might not really realize where you're getting it from. I mean, there's a famous thing. There was a composer, Don Vigeli, and he was an American composer, and he wrote the theme, the NPR theme, All Things Considered, that everybody knows, everybody listens to. He wrote that in 1971, and so it was on every day, and everybody listened to it, including John Williams. John Williams was listening to it, and he, you know, was driving to work every day, and things. You know, listen to all this stuff, writing Star Wars, Superman. But when he wrote Jaws, there's a cut in Jaws called "Tourists on the Menu," and he uses a harpsichord, and he's using French horns, and you know, typical John Williams stuff. But if you listen to it, it's just It's just the NPR All Things Considered theme playing really slow. And people wrote to him and said, hey, isn't that NPR? And he was totally embarrassed because he didn't realize. And he wrote to Don Vigeli and he's like, hey, don't worry about it. I think it sounds great. And he never, you're like, you'd think there'd be a massive copyright thing. What are you doing? But it was like, hey, I'm honored that you thought that little motif would work in your great big movie. And, you know, he didn't ask for a check, but, you know, it's like, okay, that's all right.
It's pretty cool. And I mean, look, what you come down against is that there are only 12 notes in the chromatic scale in Western music, right?
Yeah.
And so at some point, bom bing doon ding, bom bing doon ding, bom bing doon ding. Yes, did I come up with that today? Well, that's what my fingers played. But in the history of music, how many other people have gone bom bing doon ding? Lots. And so nothing is actually original. It's more rediscovery and re-rapping to me, you know?
Yeah.
And who's got the clever rap is the question of the day.
Wow. And then just hopefully you don't get sued for it. I mean,
well, and it's funny, you know, there used to be the thing of, seven notes. I don't know if you guys ever heard that. Like, if you're going to go steal Star Wars, you go bom, be, da, 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 ba, and then you're good. As long as you don't go ba, don't get that seventh note, John can't sue you. As it turns out, that is not true at all. If they put a jury of your peers and they go bom, be, da, 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 and the jury goes ba, da, you're screwed. That's it. You're done.
Oh man, I told myself I wasn't gonna do another big round of reminiscing, but this episode super quick, Tom, that just sends me screaming back. Westwood Elementary, you and I played a piano duet.
Yes,
and so that was you using all 40 fingers on each of your hands and your feet and everything else, and we did the Star Wars theme, and I was there, one finger sitting to your right, doing the da da.
Dude, you were holding down the. The bus, though, I mean, that, you don't have that. You don't have, you got Bobby, Dobby, Dobby. That's all you got left.
I didn't, I don't like to brag, but, and, you know, I mean, there was, look, in retrospect, and I'm not being modest when I say it was hysterical. There was nobody on any planet thought we were equals doing that, but we did it together. It was a lot of fun. It's a great memory. And then toward the end, there's this great big flourish and you're starting at the bottom and you're running up. And I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of notes you're playing per second and going up and up and up. And you get to the top of the keyboard and you bumped me off the bench. And that was the big, that was the climax.
That was our Victor Borga shtick. We stole that straight off of celebrity television. Right,
exactly. So, and that was the big finish. And I remember like trusting that it would be funny because there, you know, there's a little part of me saying, well, we don't want to get shoved up.
Yeah, Tom's knocking me on the floor. Why am I the butt of this joke? I don't like
and
that.
Then, and then I realized, okay, I can only play with one finger and barely that. But you know, it brought down the house.
Bro, you got the big laugh. That's all you want, right?
I learned a good lesson. I got a reaction, you know, good, bad, or indifferent. No such thing as bad publicity.
There's none. Wow. None, well, none at all.
I have an aviation question for Hal. As we're watching the plane picking up speed in this big, you know, cave hangar and stuff, and it's got all engines running and they're zooming away. Can you actually generate lift inside of a hangar that's enclosed like that? I mean, where's the air going? It doesn't seem to be able to get under the airfoil there.
So, well, that's an interesting question. I think we'll spend more time like going into the airplane stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. There's a mic thump for you to edit, Jim. You're welcome. We'll spend more time going into the airplane stuff later, but really that piece of it is plausible. Now you'd have questions like, what's the elevation? How thick is this air? It's open to the outside. So as long as you're getting some air, I mean, you know, the airplane, the airfoil doesn't really care about it being in a confined space. In theory, at some point, you know, if you get if you're in a hangar roof that's 1 inch above the top of your wing, you know, something like that could disrupt it. But that part of this scene is not necessarily problematic. I mean, it's kind of the aeronautical equivalent of something like, well, how, you know, we can't send a rocket to the moon because there's sort of nothing to push against.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, the physics at this point is saying, you know, there's air in the building. And the air going over the top of the wing is going faster than the air going underneath the wing. That's creating lower pressure. And whether you want to talk Newton or Bernoulli.
I was going to say Newton wins.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. then, you know, it is it's eventually going to lift off. But a fascinating question.
If that if that cave was either in a partial vacuum or at the top of Mount Rainier.
Well, it now is we've in the Alps.
It is in the Alps.
But it's 500 feet below ground, though. So I don't know if it's if they're coming out of a trench.
So what is the average atmospheric pressure? I mean, that would be that would be lift, right?
Hot.
So yeah, exactly. And the higher you go, I mean, in effect, in this case, as long as the engines can perform, and it, you know, an airplane like this is meant to fly at high altitudes, so those engines are going to work. But the higher you go, the longer, the more runway you need is really what it comes down to. So the less dense the air, you got to move farther to get enough of those molecules moving over the top to get it to lift.
So how, question on that really quickly. When we were kids flying control line Cox 049s, right?
Yeah.
The wings, sometimes we build the kits and the wings would have an airfoil shape creating lift. But oftentimes it seemed that the plane itself had such little mass and the engine had such great thrust that really all you needed was an elevator to point the thrust in the correct direction, and lift really didn't have anything to do with it because lift was all coming from the prop, which was overcoming anything the wings could possibly do.
So it had, it would have less to do with it, not necessarily nothing to do with it. So I mean, if you talk about with, you know, if you can move it fast enough, a barn door can fly,
right?
But what it comes down to is, so like what we may not have noticed on those little you know, those little control line things, like the, is it the Wizard and that
Wizard
kind of stuff?
That flat wings, just one piece of balsa wood, no
totally
curve.
Flat a totally flat wing. And you see aerobatic airplanes that have either fairly flat wings or symmetrical airfoils, same curve on the top as on the bottom.
Is the pits is flat or is the pits curved?
So it's, the pits is pretty well curved, but some of the modern extras and stuff like that will have a symmetrical airfoil. But what it comes down to then is what we call the angle of attack. So you imagine, instead of creating that pressure differential by having a different shape of the wing, a curve on the top, flat on the bottom, if it's flat on both sides, we are tipping that nose up. And so now we're taking this flat surface and we're moving it at a slight angle. Now, as you said, very lightweight aircraft. The, you know, those little F-49 engines had plenty of power. In theory, you could kind of translate yourself into rocket territory, tear the wings off and still have an elevator. And if you could get it spinning fast enough, it would sort of move in the air. But on those flat surfaces, it's just that slight upward angle that is enough to generate enough lift for something so light that's going so fast.
As Tom said, Newton wins. If you've got air going down, the plane goes up.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's the same thing on a dive boat. When you're on a scuba dive boat and you're over 300 feet of water and you're trying to hold things, and really the big goal is don't drop it, because you'll never get it back. We always remind each other on the dive boat, yeah, guess what? Gravity still works. Yeah, still working, still gravity.
That's a good reminder.
You know, it's been well over 50 years for me, but the mention of a Cox 049, my right index finger, the first joint, started aching from the...
snapback.
The razor-like projectile that's known as the propeller, and that...
Right. And they had that little spring.
Well, that was the upgrade, wasn't it? Like, the spring came later, spring, because at first the spring wasn't there, and you just had to, like, whack it as hard as you could.
Yeah, it's...
I almost bought a can of 049 fuel just to, like, sit and smell it. My brain remembers that smells, like, almost better than a Sharpie, but I actually don't remember what it really smells like. So
it's probably heavily regulated now.
Yeah.
I don't think I can buy it on Amazon and ship it to Cali. I don't know.
You just got yourself on a list, Tom. So congratulations.
So water-based planes now. Well, this has been a really good minute. I still want to know about the vibranium propellers, because I couldn't figure out how it hits the shield several times, and there's still a propeller left, which,
glancing blows.
Glancing blows.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it was interesting. One of the things musically, really quickly, what he did here, because the last minute we didn't have any music, really, punches and hits and stuff. But this is a really good example for aspiring composers to take a peek at. And one of the things, here's your homework, aspiring composers and music nerds. What Alan does here, not a lot of themes. And here's what I will ask you to notice, because for my job, I geek out on this stuff. So we talked last time about, where does music fit with dialogue and sound effects? Well, this is a good thing to go. There's not a lot of dialogue. So where are we hearing the airplane in the car, and where is music coming up? So listen to the mix there and see where they're choosing to go. Big engine noise, not much music. And now, hey, he did something heroic. Let's bring the little theme up, and really how they're writing the elements to accentuate picture, number one. Number two, you can listen and see how Silvestri is choosing when to do what. And it's always fascinating to me, like, okay, we're going to start an action scene. Now, this has been going on for a minute, so we're coming in. But the wheels are turning, or the plane is spinning, or something is driving. So we're going to have motion. Or you're going to find some kind of musical motif that's going to give you movement. So he's got that going on. Then you're going to realize that anything that's going chugga 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 is the first thing to disappear when things get noisy. So then what do you need to cut through? Long tones, long notes of music, whether they're low or high, when they're sustained, they're able to stay apparent even when all of the chaos is coming up and down. So he's got some rhythm and some motor. He's got some long tones that let you know, even if the effects are domineering, that you can, oh, music's still in, I can still perceive. Then watch how he's playing. Sometimes you'll do what we call Mickey Mousing. Right? You're actually commenting on the action. Other times, like when he jumps for the landing gear, you're going to see build, 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 build. Ah, no music. When he lands, right? This was interesting to me. They're late, which means the orchestra was a little behind when they recorded it, or they wanted to slip it. Sometimes you'll, as a composer, go, and then you stop. Then the car blows up. Then you come back in. Other times you'll go, and the last note of your music is actually with the explosion. Same thing when you're jumping. Sometimes it's, so it was really interesting for me to watch how they're spotting, and like, is he playing on the action? Is he completely out of the way of the action? Or is he coming after the action and leaving space for these things to happen? So there's your homework when we're, and this is why I can't watch a movie in peace anymore. My brain is like, what are they doing? And why did he do that? I wouldn't have done that. I wonder who told him to do that. Did the director want that, or did he? So it's really fascinating to see every moment of film that goes by, whether you're talking about the composer, the art director, the cinematographer, whatever, there's a million decisions in every moment of film, and you just have to pick one. And there can be a bunch of right answers, like there's also a bunch of wrong answers, but it's really fascinating to see in all of these projects where they decided out of the million possibilities the one correct answer laid, and then are they right? Right. And yeah. So when a sky captain, they made a million decisions. And in my estimation, about 200,000 of them were not as good as they could have been. Right. And so there's no such thing as a perfect movie. But when I watch something and it's like, wow, oh, man, every single one of the choices they made from soup to nuts was tasty and satisfying and served the story. That to me, that's where the art of really, really knowing how to make a motion picture come to life lives, right? When all of those things dance together.
Tom, do you have any thoughts on this particular Captain America theme? I mean, Alan Silvestri comes up with six notes that define the whole movie. I mean, they're really beautiful, triumphant notes. And I think, you know, it's just like a 1-5 thing.
Yeah, 1-5, 1-5-7-6. For whatever it is, it is they are strange intervals, right? So the ascending fifth, for those of you that aren't musical, we take the musical scale and we basically break it up into 8 large intervals or 12 smaller intervals, and we define intervals by how many of these things exist between note one and note two. So if you have a whole step, that's body, that's 1-3, body, 4, ba-da, 5, body. This is how many notes in between. So we are taught as kids, like, here comes the bride. That's a 4th. Bum, bum, ba-da, that's 4. 1-2-3-4. So a heroic interval, bum, ba-da-da-dee, that ascending fifth is very heroic. Anytime we do this musically, people go, happy triumph. If you go, ba-da, minor 3rd to 1, this is sad. People go, oh, something bad has happened. And so his theme here is using bom, ba, 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 it's they're fifths, but they're upside down. So they're a 4th if you go up, but they're a 5th if you go down, or vice versa. And so he's done a really, really good job of, it's simple. It evokes the proper emotion with the minimum amount of material necessary. And you don't have to sing it to somebody 19 times before they can sing it back to you. So I, you know, and whether you're talking about Forrest Gump, ba-da-dee-dee, very simple, very memorable, very easy to comprehend. It's a C major scale, more or less. Brilliant. You've got Back to the Future, which I sang before. Interesting. 5-1. Now, he does something very strange. There's an interval called the tritone, also in the olden times called the devil's interval. This was considered a wicked interval, and you would have people running out of church if you played this. So in his Back to the Future theme, he goes 5-1 tritone, buddy dee dee do tritone. So he's all over the devil's interval with that one, right? And so to listen to him do all of these things where it's either rule breaking or it's the minimal amount, he's so good at distilling just what you need. And when I go ba ba be da da da, people go, oh, Back to the Future. In the same way, there are so few composers, right? John Williams is one of the only other ones that come to mind where you can go ba da da ba do da da, and they go, oh yeah, Indiana Jones, right? You don't need a lot of information to have the people recognize it. And I think Alan is another one of these guys that's really, really, really stinking good at that.
I want Tom on all our podcasts.
Yeah.
every episode. Tom, we got to have you.
You'll never be done. That's the problem. It'll each be an hour long. And you know,
There's people that are saying, I'm just going to do another three laps on this Peloton. I know they're listening on the podcast.
The Peloton's waiting for me in the other room, kids.
Finally, we've got somebody on that knows what they're talking about.
Finally.
100 episodes of this stuff. Wow. Well,
I love it.
Tom, it's great having you on. I know we're going to have you on again. We've got to get you back in here. And I know a lot of people want to continue this conversation. And as I always tell people, if you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base over on Facebook. If you do like the show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our great big website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests, including Tom, who will have a link to Brand X Music if you want to find out more about Tom's line of work. But please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.